realize as you know, a result of your work, so that you can then, and I was going to, by the way, recommend that you speak to the people, the asthma program of West Michigan, and how they have very similar results as yours, and were able to get all of the insurers in West Michigan to pay for the ongoing work of their organization. So you'll want to speak to them to see what their strategy is so that you can get funding beyond. But it's so important to be able to quantify this.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering whether you've tried to do that from a cost perspective. So
does anyone else have a quick?
Well, should I answer that? Okay, because I don't know if I'll be able to remember all the different questions. So I'll start with this last question. So right now, one of the things we're trying to do is actually to get the hospital to pay for the program, because this New York Presbyterian Hospital, the grant is actually administered through the hospital, and but they're not paying for the program itself. So what we're trying to do is show them the value of the program in terms of reducing the length of stay for children in the hospital. And actually, we have been able to show that our program does impact the length of stay. And if anyone, I'm not going to get into too much detail about this, but if you know the way the hospital works for asthmatics, they actually get less money for asthmatics in the hospital. So the longer that child takes up the bed in the hospital, the more money that the hospital is losing. So if we can show that we're reducing the length of stay, then that impacts their bottom line. So that's one of the strategies that we're doing. And then also with our negotiations with managed care organizations, we're trying to quantify the impact in that area as well. So we're exploring. And then your other question was about training. So we have a very small program. I didn't put this into context for all of you, but we have 4 community health workers. And actually, we've had very little turnover among community health workers, which I think is one of the keys to our success. When they first started, they were involved in an intensive training program. We utilized the resources at Columbia. There's a community health worker training institute there. And then we continue to give them ongoing training on different areas as they come up. But they're... again, I think retaining them has been a big key to our success, because you know they're just building on their knowledge. And also because they're in the community, they have access to all of these different resources, and they're constantly learning about different resources that they can share with our families. So it's really an ongoing process. In terms of structural changes.
Well, I noticed on the sheet that you put up the checklist, things like wet ceilings or holes and things like that. So the equipment manager probably had to get involved at some level.
Right. Okay. So that is a challenge for us, because as I've mentioned, many of our families have delicate home lives and situations that they don't necessarily want to pursue that. So a lot of families would prefer to live in those environments and actually push that. But what we're trying to do, again, is to get funding and support to get professional integrated pest management services for those families, because, again, the strategies that we share with our families don't quite won't make that big of an impact when there are larger structural problems. So that's a really good question. And then, again, through our network of partners, we're able to refer families for different housing programs and different legal services so that they could be more empowered to make some bigger changes. But it really is on a case-by-case basis and very much dependent on the family. It's a good question. Exactly.
Good morning. Again, my name is Jane Malone, and I'm with the Alliance for Healthy Homes. We're a national public interest organization, and we're focused on eliminating exposure to hazards in the home environment, largely through policy development and capacity building. I have no conflicts here, no relationships disclosed, nothing of interest. I should say before I start out that the work that I'm presenting on is part of highlights from a paper, copies of which were in the back of the room, thanks to Laurie Stillman. The paper was developed under commission by the Boston Public Health Commission and Asthma Regional Council with support from the Kellogg Foundation. So reducing pesticides in housing, what are the overarching issues and opportunities here? First of all, rental property owners and tenants are often unaware the cost of either the cost of exposure to pesticides and even to pests, as well as the benefits of IPM. Integrated pest management is a set of strategies that are basically available to reduce the use of pesticides in the home environment while at the same in other environments too, while at the same time reducing the or eliminating pests. IPM is effective, durable, and inexpensive. There's been lots of studies about that. There's been demonstrable progress regarding reducing the use of pesticides in schools and workplaces, in agriculture, protecting the food supply, and other settings. Publicly owned property is a ready model. It's embedded in, it's actually one of the simplest policy measures that a local or state government can take to commit to at least reducing the use of pesticides on public property. The opportunity for simple policies here with reducing exposure to pesticides, it's basically that old public health principle, do no harm. Key policy levers, there's sort of three different kinds that I'm going to be talking about. And again, there's a lot more information in the paper. Today, I'm really going to just focus on what are some policy opportunities, what are the things that we can do in public policy to, across the whole population, reduce exposure to pesticides in housing. First of all, local and state codes. For those of you who are familiar, sanitary housing codes, property maintenance codes, those are the codes that regulate the condition of properties as it is occupied often. That's the kind of code that drives whether or not a rental property will get what's called a certificate of occupancy, permission for the owner to rent out the property. Many codes already prohibit pests in some way. The default policy of the International Code Council Property Maintenance Code is, you know, to prohibit pests across the board without specifying the safest ways to do that. The second category of key policy lever is EPA and state regulators. Pesticide use and who can apply pesticides is a matter of federal policy governed by EPA regulations, and then basically that policy, that power rather, is delegated to states. I'll get back to that in a couple minutes. Basically, the opportunities with EPA and state regulation are requiring pesticide applicators to know use IPM, to restrict the use, the sale, access to any pesticides, and particularly in this case, liquefied toxic products, and also another big area is whether there can be notice to occupants about the use of pesticides. And finally, the third general category is federal standards, guidance, and funds. What else can happen at the federal level beyond the current array of pesticide regulations under EPA? And I've gone backwards, excuse me. Okay, so first of all, generally federal opportunities for federal policy change or federal recommendations. We would look to HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, to actually comply with FIFRA. FIFRA is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act that basically said, you know, in all federal property, we need to reduce the risk of pesticide use and focus on IPM. HUD has missed a big opportunity, which is to actually regulate, direct all public housing authorities to, you know, ban the use of pesticides and unilaterally require IPM throughout public housing. That said, HUD has done lots of nice things to provide technical assistance and support and training for those property owners, public housing authorities that want to opt into IPM, and many have done that, but that's very different from HUD actually using the policy authority it received under FIFRA. Similarly, we look to HUD to issue standards or some kind of guidance for what should be going on privately owned housing, as often happens with other areas that HUD regulates. They begin with what goes on in public housing, and then they can say something about what how to generalize that information to the rest of the housing stock. Look to EPA and USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, through particularly its cooperative extension programs to promote IPM in the housing sector. Both of these agencies have done an incredible job supporting, promoting IPM in schools and other institutional settings, and they've really kind of missed the boat, with some couple of exceptions, in terms of promoting IPM use in the housing sector. And thirdly, at the federal level, we look to Congress to direct EPA to advance effective IPM, to be more specific about what IPM should be doing, what EPA should be doing, and to authorize incentive grants. And of course, there's always this sort of untapped authority at every level here, at Congress, within EPA, and at the state's level, which is to restrict, finally, once and for all, access to the use of boggers and bombs and sprays. There were some studies just the past couple weeks, information released about the particular dangers of foggers, and the Alliance hopes to be moving on some kind of action on that very soon. Secondly, moving to the state level, away from the federal level, background, I talked about this a little bit already, EPA delegated powers to states it's basically two categories, the authority to register or therefore regulate pesticides and the ability to certify or control through licensing what pest control operators and applicators can be doing. The things that can be done more strongly at state level include expectations around how pest control operators are qualified, whether or not they're trained in IPM and using it, the oversight powers there, and then the states also can issue special use certifications saying that an IPM applicator, excuse me, a pesticide applicator has must have a particular structural or another kind of certification for use in buildings. At any rate, our recommendations for pest control program policies for states are, first of all, requiring notice to applicants. The best model for this is what the state of Maine is doing. Basically, that policy says that there has to be advance notice provided to occupants, and a tenant can object, can call the number on the note or contact their property owner and say, I object to being exposed to this pesticide, and that pesticide cannot be used. IPM first policy, minimizing exposure, human risk, is another big part of what states can be doing to require pesticide control operators to identify, again, this is something else that Maine is doing, to actually identify specific pests being addressed and the conducive conditions and make specific recommendations for non-pesticide control measures. A lot of what I'm saying here is things that are considered to be good IPM practice. And the trick here is, of course, in policymaking, are we going to require that those practices be used across the population by all who touch pesticides? That's a really good example that, of course, you want any good pest control operator to be pest-specific, talk about the infestation and conducive conditions and make the recommendations for control measures. In addition, states can require IPM training for pesticide applicators. Prohibit the sale and use access to toxics in the first place, and finally, this happened in a couple places, including New Hampshire, using pesticide registration fees for incentives for different property owners and levels of government to actually move on IPM policy. Another part of state policy, in addition to what could be happening, the pesticide control program, which is sort of one side of the story, is what can happen at the state level, where states have a role in housing. specifically, state housing and health codes, as I mentioned earlier, some specific examples on the slide here from Massachusetts and Vermont, and there's a good example in New Jersey. There's a real opportunity to just say out loud in the housing code what should go on in terms of efforts to not only eliminate pests, but to prevent pesticide habitat and pest access to the property. In addition, states have a special opportunity in their management of low-income housing tax credits and other kinds of funds for housing to require that new developments follow basically standards that are friendly to reducing exposure to pesticides. An example, this is in Connecticut, asthma-safe building standards. In addition, there are things called green building and Energy Star standards. And by the way, some of these policies that one can put forth in housing development plans not only reduce pesticide exposure but also address other problems like forestalling air leaks, moisture problems. In addition, states can mandate IPM in state-owned facilities, as I was mentioning earlier, that simplest, lowest common denominator kind of policy. I keep going backwards on the slides, and I apologize for that. moving to localities, what can happen at the local level? Well, the big power, given that states really control the pesticide policies and pesticide control applicator policies, really you're leaving the localities generally with the opportunity to do something with codes and with what happens in the local housing stock. As happens in New York City and San Francisco, the codes should require property owners to use IPM and reduce use of pesticides in eliminating pest exposure. Again, most codes already say there shouldn't be pests, so we've got the floor of policy here. We need to build on that floor by adding how and where, under what circumstances, property owners should be expected to eliminate those pests without exposing the residents to the toxics. In addition, public and subsidized housing can and should use IPM. Model contract specification in Boston, New York City are examples of that. Housing-related funding, localities can tie access to CDBG and home, for example, to whether or not the properties rehabbed, repaired, or built with those funds are addressing pesticide exposure issues. And if there is pest issues, prioritizing use of IPM. And finally, there's sort of a little tiny piece of pesticide policy, which is many states now preempt localities from actually, doing something in terms of at the local level in terms of reducing access to pesticides. Reversing state preemption policies is a key part for those cities that want to take this program into their own hands at another state level where the states are allowing pesticides to be distributed. Just some background on codes. There already are some provisions. They're listed on the slide there, tight building envelope, preventing ingress through how the pipes and conduits are constructed, storing materials away from the exterior walls of the structure, et cetera. And generally speaking, there are two categories of opportunity. Construction codes govern structure design, and those affect whether a property can actually come into the market. And then the housing codes, sanitary codes, property maintenance codes, are the ones that govern the condition, habitability, and they're enforced at turnover in some localities, periodic inspections, and always, in most places where there is a code, at least a complaint to the local code authority can affect compliance. Improving codes for IPM, treating both the infestation and toxic pesticide use as serious code violations. Right now, infestation is not necessarily treated as seriously as it should be. And, of course, toxic pesticide use should also be a violation of codes. And there should be requirements of IPM for IPM used by rental property owners. Those basic strategies that we know now are good practice, that group of strategies should be expected of property owners. Finally, just one last point, recommendations for health payers. I know we heard some good examples in New York City a couple minutes ago. Reiterating what's the funding stream, what's the support here. We do need the individual patient protected from pesticide pest exposure. Healthcare agencies can name the infestation pesticide use as vectors of asthma, and the payers can factor the IPM benefits in reducing asthma respiratory problems. There's lots that can happen here in terms of higher expectations of healthcare payers. I'm going to stop there. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Is there one very quick question for Jane?
You mentioned that you're